a Monday afternoon. Welcome to David Foster Wallace and Gromit. I'm Jared. With me, as always, is Steve. And this is the officially unlicensed Infinite Jest Fancast, a podcast that celebrates the seminal novel of David Foster Wallace, Infinite Jest, postmodern masterpiece. Before we get into our novella for the week and in turn Infinite Jest, Steve had said he wanted to do a little bit of a film talk, a departure from our usual tune talk. So what have you watched this week? You spearhead this effort.
Well, I gotta put in this. I have one highly recommend, and then I have one maybe skip it. You know,
okay.
One is a definite. You know, you got five sailor's hats. And the other one's maybe a three. So the five, of course, is Inside Llewyn Davis by the Coen Brothers, which I decided to give another look, watch.
Okay.
That one's a classic. I have you seen that?
Yeah,
I've
seen that. Yeah.
It's based off a guy named Dave Van Ronk.
Okay, so that's
Greenwich Village folk scene in 1960s, the early 1960s.
So that's the five. That's the five hatter. That's the five out of five. What's the three hatter?
It's new. It was in 2017, and it was a horror flick.
Okay.
And it's a British one.
Okay.
And it's about Scandinavian gods, or a Scandinavian god.
Are you talking about Ritual?
Am I supposed to say that? I don't know.
Are you talking about Ritual?
I spoiled it.
The Netflix one. Yeah, you spoiled
what
it.
What was that?
Ritual, that came out this weekend on Netflix.
Ritual.
Okay, because that was going to be my movie, too.
What?
That was going to be my movie, too, because I just watched that on Friday.
Okay.
Yeah.
You watched it, too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a spooky one.
You know, I wasn't a big fan. I didn't think it was scary. No.
Well, in the beginning it was. Once they showed the monster, as much as I enjoyed the direction that they took for it, I thought it was a very, like, creative design, it wasn't scary anymore. And then also, like, spoiler for everyone listening out there, as much of the story was supposed to be this redemptive tale, or, like, you know, we're talking about how the main character's going through and, like, dealing with his survivor's guilt, and then what that kind of manifested itself as in his hallucinations. Or the hallucinations projected upon him, or like the way reality sort of warped. But then in the end, it's just him walking away, and there was no resolution. There was no like, and now I'm a stronger, braver man, or now I'm this, now I'm that. It's like, nope, my friends still died. All of my friends died. Now they're all dead. And I, as the lone survivor, right. I'm just going to wander through the woods.
Yeah, I mean,
Yeah.
Or not wander through the woods. Like, wander... Where was he? He was outside of the woods or whatever.
No, but he still had a ways to go. I mean, he was out of the woods, literally, in a very like spatial sense. But he had to still get to the lodge, and that creature was still there.
Hey, well, at least I'm out of the woods.
Yeah, well, ugh.
No, I didn't. I wasn't a big fan. It was. I don't know. It seemed to follow every cliche archetype.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I thought the movie was going to be really good at the beginning when it had the whole, like...
The setup was very impressive.
The whole backstory with the friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, the setup was really good. And then...
It was very shocking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, you open it up and it's like, whoa, this is going to be a real classic.
A real spook fest, yeah.
But, sorry, it wasn't.
You want to know why? And I realized this after I'd watched it. So I wanted to watch it because David Bruckner was the guy who directed... he was one of the contributing directors for the original VHS. And he had done the first segment. I don't know if you've seen VHS. But it was... I loved it. One of the better horror anthologies I think ever made. And then after the success of that, he went on and did... He produced a couple things and then did a segment for Southbound, which was the original creators of VHS... Once their IP was kind of soiled after it got bought, they did Southbound, which was a more conventional narrative and camera style horror anthology movie, which was, again, fantastic. And the segment he contributed was really jarring, and I still think about it a lot. It was, I think it was just called The Accident, but really unsettling and, like, just a real masterpiece in terms of an anthology horror or horror short. And the problem with this movie was that he can tell a great story writing and directing these shorts, but writing and directing, or I think he just directed it, and it was based on a book, also called The Ritual. Directing something of this scale.
This one? Really?
Yeah, it was based on a book. Now that we know how long the book is, for those listening, we wanted to read for the pod, we looked it up, it's like 400 pages. Now that I know how long it is, that even more so makes sense as to why we have a director who's done so well in a medium of horror shorts and anthology series, trying to convey a larger story, or trying to direct a more conventional narrative, a much more expansive story, and trying to world build this whole like Norse mythology kind of thing. It just wasn't for him. It was a bad director for the project, unfortunately.
Yeah, maybe so. Because, yeah, the Norse mythology thing, I mean, it didn't really come into play.
Not really. I mean, it was touched on so briefly.
Just like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Like, they worship. And I'm also, again, I'm not a big fan of the whole monster thing. I don't really find that to be too engaging.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, okay, great, we've got another huge monster, this little, you know, that can pick people up and stick them against trees. Like, whoa, uh-oh, darn, here we go again.
I just liked it because it...
I would much prefer, like, insanity.
Yeah.
Or, you know, something a little more jarring as a subject.
Especially because the setup. Yeah, the setup is so much about, like, oh, look how psychologically broken this group of friends is in the wake of their friend's murder, and the Survivor's Guild and all these sort of things coming into play. And then it's like, oh, just kidding, it's a monster. And it's like, oh, it's a monster, and not only is it a monster, but like the other characters, what they're experiencing in regards to the event put against them. I mean, like, it's all very dissociative. By like halfway through, you realize that none of it really matters. It's kind of just like, oh, there's something scary happening in the woods. And we're in the woods because of this thing. But I felt like those stories should have... It's like you had a lot going on up here. It all kind of pinholed once they got to the forest. And then it opens back up again in a totally different story. And it's like, no, I still want to know what's going on with their like PTSD and how they're mourning their friend. Right. And then it kind of just like, nope, we're done with that. We're in the forest now. But I mean...
It fairly poorly deals with the concept of death, or I don't know, fear, or whatever, because it's kind of like, you start to get an idea of this psychological aspect of witnessing your friend's murder, effectively, and this whole weight on the friend group, and by, you know, halfway through, you're like, oh, well, everybody's dead, so why do I care?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean...
Like, guess they're all dead. Guess you've got five, you know, fatherless families now.
Yeah.
Darn, at the hands of this monster character thing that's this god that people worship.
Sort of like Lovecraftian, arcane, timeless horror. I liked its little arms. I don't want to spoil it for people listening, but I liked its little arms. That was big for me. Because at first I was like, oh, it's a big... like deer or something. But then when you see its little hands, and then you understand, like, the effigy that they made was just its head. And I was like, oh, I like that. That did it for me. Just in terms of design. But no, I mean, for what it was, Netflix original shows, for the most part, are pretty well made and good writing team, good direction. Netflix original movies, I would say 99% of the time, are absolute shit. So for a Netflix original movie to not be a complete and total clusterfuck, I was like, okay, cool, I'm into it. Because the Cloverfield Paradox, another Netflix...
Are they usually?
Huh?
Are they usually bad?
They're usually...
I don't know.
Think of it, Bright. Bright was like one of the most critically panned movies of recent years. The Cloverfield Paradox, which was Paramount production, and Netflix bought it, was just terrible. I watched that the other day. Most Netflix original movies are pretty bad, except for Beasts of No Nation. Which was very good with Idris Elba. But I would say this, if you're listening, if you like maybe like a Blair Witch adjacent kind of story, or like, this is a little bit more of a deep cut, but I had likened it previously to Baskin, which was, I think, a Romanian horror movie from 2015, Romanian or Hungarian. It was very dark, but same kind of idea. Or Yellow Brick Road, which was a movie that came out in 2008, that is still, it's become kind of like a cult classic among a lot of people in the horror genre, for people who want like a very conventional genre film, and it had that kind of feeling. So if you like genre films, if you like maybe an idea of like a dependable horror mainstay, if you want to go into something knowing that it's going to be like a B-rate horror movie with a good production budget, I'd say check it out. if you got, and it's like an hour and a half, you know? If you want to sit down and get a little spook going.
Yeah, that's a good thing. That's the good thing. It's not like a 2.5 hour.
No, it's very low commitment.
It was a nice, fairly short movie. You can have a nice little watch and say no if you don't like it.
Watch it while you eat dinner.
By the way.
Huh?
Baskin is Turkish.
Oh, Turkish, shit. That's why I was having such a hard time finding it the other day. Yeah, have you seen that?
No. That's Baskin and Yellow Brick Road are the two you said?
Yeah, Yellow Brick Road.
I mean, Yellow Brick Road, I guess it seems pretty obvious what it's going to be about looking at the cover of it.
Why do you say that?
I don't know. They don't really seem to hide anything about in terms of what it's about.
But I would say if you get a chance, watch that and watch Baskin. I think Baskin might be on Netflix, and boy, is that troublesome.
Okay.
That's a real brutal one. But no, this is a good segue. I texted you before we started earlier today about how if I had was given the opportunity to direct a film adaptation of Concrete Island by J.G. Ballard, our book for the week, I would jump on that in a heartbeat. Because let me tell you right now, in reading this,
is that your number one? If you had a book to adapt a film into as a director, what would be number one though?
You know what? I actually would say it's number one because I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking. Well, so okay. here is the circumstance under which I would say that. It's like I produce or I direct or I star in or I do whatever I write. A movie, it does the, like, this is very, for everyone listening, this is not, like, wishful thinking. This is, like, in another lifetime kind of idea. But it does the festival circuit. It's very, it's critically lauded. And then I do the little Hollywood career kind of thing. And then after a couple years of being known as a creative and being, like, celebrated as such, like, if I was, like, a Lars von Trier character, if I was, like, a Werner Herzog or a Paul Thomas Anderson, and someone said, "Oh, you're gonna work, you know, adapt a book. What book do you want to adapt?" I'd say this, because I think that this would read very well as a low dialogue, very pastoral kind of movie, probably about 2 hours. And I'm like, I don't know. Reading it, I was picturing in a very cinematic nature a lot of the scenes, like when Proctor, you know, spoilers for anyone who's listening who's gonna read the book, but when Proctor like hung himself, I could picture that. I could picture how like I would lay out that scene. The duel, I think the chapter was just called The Duel, but him pissing on Proctor. Basically, any interaction with Proctor, I understood exactly how that scene would play out, especially just because I felt so bad for him, and it was kind of like creating a narrative around, or a more like a splinter narrative around Proctor and the idea of Proctor. But we're getting ahead of ourselves here. But no, actually, you know, while we're on it, if you had the opportunity to adapt something, what would you adapt? And this is you have to write the screenplay too.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of books, I mean, it would be Crying a Lot 49 is a good shout.
Yeah.
That would be, there's something about that that would be kind of classic. But also, I mean.
Has it been done before?
Good question. I have no idea.
I thought you would say Proctor.
I mean, if I were to do anything. Good Man is Hard to Find or Good Country Folk by Flannery O'Connor, but those are both short stories.
I mean, that's fine.
But those are two that I would go nuts to be involved in making into, you know, because there are a couple of the ones where there's no, you obviously have no image of it in your mind when you're reading it. Like, I don't know, sometimes for books, you certainly have an image of it in your mind because you've seen something about, right? Sun Also Rises. You have an idea of what Ernest Hemingway looks like. We all know what he looks like. And so you can't help but put him in the Jake picture when you picture him.
Sure, sure.
You know, for example. I mean, it's or if you're using historical figures like, say, Invisible Cities or some of these books that we've done.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. There's something that was so distinct in how I pictured A Good Man is Hard to Find and Good Country Folk that, like, even now when I think of the title, there's such a distinct layout of the, I don't know, for Good Country Folk, the house and the barn. There's, like, such a clear distinction
mm-hmm.
What people are wearing, Like, it's so obvious. And then for, say, yeah, I mean, for A Good Man Is Hard to Find, it would be easy because she vividly explains, describes what everybody's wearing. So
well,
that
actually,
be easy.
That's a good point then. So are you saying it's easy really and you can see it as a prospective director, a theoretical director in this seat, you can see a film based on it because of how she's described it or because of your vision? Because with, like, I'm thinking about what we read this week, a lot of the backdrop, and what Ballard does a lot, I think, is, like, it's, you're mixing internal dialogue and external dialogue and sensation and kind of what's perceived. So this is something where,
so,
like,
that was more vision-based.
Right, because half of this, I mean, it took maybe, like, two chapters of this before I threw any concept I had of the island out the window. Because, like, I understood the embankment, I understood, like, kind of how we got there, but I couldn't spatially wrap my head around what this island actually looked like outside of a few cues, a few pretty hard and fast cues. And I think that's my interest in it, is, like, I would want to adapt something that is, like, intentionally obfuscated, there we go, excuse me, by the writer. You know what I mean?
Okay. We're talking about two separate things fairly, I think. Yeah, I mean, Flannery O'Connor's fairly down to earth. I just mean for the sake of...
Because, good goof, yeah.
Getting that story into a screenplay,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, writing, being able to set a stage for some of the dialogue,
yeah,
particularly in Good Country Folk.
I'm surprised that you, I'm surprised that you didn't say As I Lay Dying.
I mean, As I Lay Dying as well. Like, I watched the Interpretation movie, but think there's something about there's a reason why I didn't say As I Lay Dying. There's a reason why I wouldn't say Moby Dick. There's a reason why I wouldn't say, I don't know, say Brothers Karamazov. It's because I don't know if I've fully convinced myself that those would be something I would be willing to touch.
That's a good point.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, even with a couple of those Flannery O'Connor short stories, like, I don't know if I'd be willing to touch Good Man Is Hard to Find, really.
Yeah.
Maybe Good Country Folk is still fine no matter what, because that's funny, it's meant to be kind of silly. But there are some things where it's like, I mean, they're in book format, and I don't know if they should be touched. I don't know if they should have been touched ever.
Right.
I don't know.
I mean, I'm thinking of The Violent Barred Away. I don't think I could successfully... I can't think of any director I know who could successfully adapt that. Yeah.
That's another one. I don't know how on earth you would really do that.
Yeah, I don't think you could convey...
How on earth would you really draw out that final, not the final scene, but the scene on the boat.
Right.
Where what's-his-name is waiting there in the room, and he starts to realize what's going on. Like, how do you even begin to draw that out?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I
don't know if I would trust anyone to do that.
I think with a lot of the books we've read, there's so much emotion. There's so much emotion that to try and make a movie out of it, unless even with the best acting team, even with the best cast, you're not gonna, it's just not possible. I mean, like, and there have been film adaptations of, I think, maybe half the things we've read, and they've been not unsuccessful, but it's definitely not the source material. I know that there's a movie of
After Dying, that was definitely lacking.
Big time. Well, yeah, James Franco really, really fucked it up on that one. I know there's a film of The Sailor Who Fell from Grace with the Sea that reads basically like softcore porn, and it barely addresses the vitriol and the level of hatred that I don't remember the boy's name, but that whole narrative of, like, how embittered the boy became and how disappointed in the sailor, and, like, that whole narrative is basically disregarded. I mean Invisible Cities couldn't be filmed, The Third Policeman couldn't be filmed. A lot of it's too ethereal. And the Lovecraft stuff couldn't be filmed.
How?
Yeah.
Third Policeman, there's no way.
No. Yeah, there's no way. There's no way
it
could be done.
How would you do that?
Chronicle of a Death Foretold would be interesting. I think that if you had to film it, it'd have to be like...
That's one.
I think that'd be really
fun. That's one that could be done. Pedro Paramo, probably not. No.
Probably not.
But Chronicle of a Death Foretold, that's one maybe would be something.
The Invention of Morrell, I would watch a movie based on, because I think it would be terrifying for most of it. Because I think when you're grappling with themes of like isolation and because with this a lot of the revolving themes in this are like, I mean, we'll get into the synopsis, but it's this idea of like of being stunted emotionally or culturally and like sociopolitical strata based on technology, and then the isolation and that comes therein, and then towards the end some ideas of like courage and what it means to like live up to your expectations. But in The Invention of Morrell, isolation was a big theme, and I think to put that into film, but it's isolation amidst a full cast, because like Lost, which was I guess an adaptation, you have a lot of people who are like working together, but with this you would have one character who you are seeing such intense suffering in amidst an entire cast that is ignoring them for, if it's a 2-hour movie, for an hour and a half of it. And then finally at that, and you know, and you think this entire time, it's like, it's incredibly cruel. It would read like Sallow basically. And then that last half hour, when you realize what's happening, it would just be devastating. Yeah, fuck. Anyway.
So your movie from book would be Sallow then. Is that what I got from that?
What? No, the book that I would want to do that I would.
Oh, that was a good one.
Okay, yeah. Well, also, Sallow is a book.
Yeah, and there was already a movie as well. The joke was about Sallow, not actually the movie concept thing.
Boy, I tell you what, you know, if there's one thing that I.
That's what we should read on this podcast.
Fuck no. If there's one thing that I never want to experience again, it's Sallow. No, so Concrete Island by J.G. Ballard, published in the mid 70s. This is the second piece in his technology trilogy, so beginning with Crash, and I've read Crash, and then it's bookended by High Rise, which I read a few years ago. I've been meaning to read this for a number of years now, and I thought it'd be good to read for the pod, because we did talk about An Island technically last week, and I think some of these themes of like isolation and expectation with this in particular are really interesting, and I think as a postmodern adjacent podcast, we talk a lot about socioeconomic strata and kind of how human beings are viewing one another when allowed to be introspective. So this was a good choice, I think. The book is about Robert Maitland, who, when driving his car particularly fast, his car careens off the side of the road, ends up down this embankment of which he cannot climb out of with a broken leg or his fractured hip. And the story then, we then see him beginning to try and escape through either writing messages or he burns the car to try and get a signal fire going. And through his attempts, he eventually is confronted by the other two inhabitants of this island as he's losing his mind and becoming more and more, you know, estranged from reality. He meets these other two inhabitants. One, I don't know, I think Jane's past is pretty shrouded, but what we understand of her is maybe mentally unstable. She had a miscarriage or an abortion at some point in her past, due to some photographs that we've seen. Previously married, maybe an abusive relationship, given some of the things that she says about it. But currently, sex worker, addict. And the other inhabitant of the island is Proctor, who is a retired or maybe escaped trapeze artist who is slow or maybe autistic, has some kind of mental affliction. And these two are a real, oh boy, I wouldn't even say goofs. I feel like goofs is too lighthearted. I mean, it's tragic. Their stories are both very tragic, but the way they treat Maitlander, it might as well be a Three Stooges bit. It's just the most bitter and venomous Three Stooges bit of all time. But eventually he meets these characters. Proctor has an unfortunate death in trying to please Maitland, and Jane eventually leaves him, not understanding the truth of Proctor's death, and also in sort of an act of dominance and maybe a reverse psychology kind of goof at some point, Maitland convinces her to leave, and it's then we're led to believe that he leaves as well. But I guess it's kind of open-ended. I mean, the novel basically ends with Robert Maitland being on this island, having believed himself to have conquered some of the psychological issues that he faced in his youth with his entitlement, or maybe his sense of unrequited love, or maybe I don't know. He's a very antagonistic character who I think expects more. Like I said, expectation's a big theme here. Expects more of the world than was shown to him. And this was a very sobering, humbling experience for him, as he had to learn how to interact with people on a much more base and fundamental level, and how to get what he needed outside of just screaming and yelling and expecting the world to change for him. But yeah, I mean, it's a scary, very brutal, often sad, short novel. If I was to do a quick rating, and you know, as we talked about before, the film adaptation and what I think of Ballard's work already, I'd give it a real, you know, 8 or 9 out of 10 within the catalog of work. And as a standalone novel, I'd give it maybe like a 7 out of 10, just because the style is a little difficult to track sometimes, and these aren't likable characters. There's little redeeming value. It's meant to just be sort of a, I don't want to say parting the kimono, I think that's gross, but like opening yourself up to understanding a level of like cultural violence and of an understanding of the social strata that you really might not understand previously. And as with a lot of these works, it really centers around technology and how that intersects with those themes. I have a few notes jotted down, but what did you, I don't know, give me your thoughts on some of these themes. Give me your thoughts on what you saw this book to represent culturally.
Yeah, sure. I mean, he even refers to himself as Robinson Crusoe at one point.
Yeah.
As well, also, I think, as Robinson Crusoe, but that doesn't matter. This isn't about Robinson Crusoe. But it's an unreliable narrator, right? And we can tell.
Right.
That, yeah, of course, there isn't much to talk about in terms of morality anyway. I mean...
Well, why do you say that?
Certainly not in a clear way, but not in any, say, didactic, I think.
Sure. I mean, I don't know. I'm picturing... But if you want to talk about morality, I mean, picture the scene of him pissing on Proctor to establish dominance and then have Proctor, a human being, as a tool for his escape. And it's guided, though, by him wanting to return to his wife and to his kid and to offer some kind of salvation to Jane. I mean, that's a pretty big moral quandary if the only way to offer that level of, like, salvation and his freedom...
I suppose it's not. And it's not necessarily didactic, though. That's the thing.
Just in terms of the unreliable narrator and this sort of, like I said before, isolation and maybe what isolation, kind of like 127 hours, that kind of thing, what isolation might be able to offer you in terms of absolution or in terms of righting a wrong through introspection, through any kind of personal growth in allowing yourself to be faced with harsh reality in that regard. But I think, I don't know, I mean, as much as the book is a single character on this island, it is still first and foremost about how we interact with technology. And I'd written down a couple things that in chapter 4 I'd said that with the Maitland's monologue, that was when he said he's the island. In chapter 5 I had written down, because this is when he first finds the church and the cinema, and I'd written down that the island being a demolished neighborhood, him realizing it's a demolished neighborhood, complete with a church and gravestones, we see the anthropomorphic nature of the concrete and the road structures as they indicate a hostile takeover of technology and the death of the natural world. I said there might be something to be said about the grass on the island as an act of artificial nature or of nature's last bastion and something allowed or presented by or forced upon the scene by technology itself. And I thought a lot about like Amazon and what this idea of like technology, the introduction of a new technology, of a cutting edge technology. And at this point in time in the 70s, I think like, especially in the UK, the freeway was like cutting edge technology. You look at places like Ireland, they just got their major freeway in like 98. I want to say when I was there, that was their big thing that they wanted to talk about. So in the UK, the freeway was like a big piece of technology. And for this little island to have this little habitat, this little like biodome created by intersecting freeways, I saw the comparison to Amazon and like how Amazon, being a cutting-edge technology, created like the unmanned grocery store that we have in South Lake Union here in Seattle. As well as like the idea of the Amazon bookstore, both of which, where it's like, we're going to create an unmanned store. We're going to eliminate the need for a community market or for you having any sense of community or a human interaction in your bookstore, in your neighborhood stores. And by proxy, we're going to be bringing to this area a sense of community around this piece of tech. And the garden, this or the jungle, quote unquote, that's become an integral part of the island, and then also, you know, later on in the work with Proctor and Jane, that is this fostered, newfound sense of community, of a forced community, of the injection of nature by technology. And I thought that was kind of, I don't know, I mean, is that too much of a stretch? What do you think?
I was going to say. Also, just a quick side note. Amazon, if you would like to sponsor us, please do.
No, I'm not going to.
What I would say.
You know, Jeff Bezos could personally come to my front door and say, I love your podcast. We want to buy it and have Amazon presents David Foster Wallace and Gromit. And he could say, write your own check, and I would spit in his fucking face.
I wouldn't do that. I'm not saying I would write on the check, but I would at least invite him in for a cup of tea.
He would not get any kindness from me. Okay. Anyway, do you want to talk about what was
David Gromit? This is not a shared opinion. This is
no. This is a shared opinion.
To Jared opinion.
Did you?
I'm piggybacking on what you're saying.
Yeah.
Another thing to mention in terms of. I mean, the obvious example, very obvious example, is the highway scene fairly near the beginning, right, where he's trying to fly on cars and screaming his wife's name, and nobody's, you know, they just faceless machines just, you know, and there's no help, and it's another thing. I don't know if we talked about this before. But, I mean, maybe a more modern variant of that is a street with people who are on their phones or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, okay.
Looking at the phone or talking on the phone or, you know, sitting down and being on a phone where it's kind of like, you know, you really can't, in a societal environment, you really can't depend on anyone or anything in terms of, I mean, I do want to make sure to, mentioned, this isn't necessarily a complaint or anything like that. I'm not, or maybe, okay, it's something to be aware of, maybe, I don't know. But I don't necessarily think that there's any sense of security. So that's what the freeway scene made me think of, that it's like, oh, you know, you crash, there's no sense of security if you actually need help. The yeah. reliability... I mean, the freeway, cars, the need to go somewhere really kind of negates any sense of obligation therein. So I thought that was maybe an interesting thing to think about because, yeah, okay, 1974 was this one. And, okay, yeah, fast forward a number of years. Fast forward a few decades, and you've got now, and it's like, yeah, that's... maybe the modern equivalent. I don't know as much necessarily about, like, Amazon, for example. I mean, maybe throw that into the ring. But for me, what I thought of was, like, the idea of a phone or something. I mean, yeah, because it seems like anywhere you go in the world, too, it's... Even for something less severe than a, serious car collision. I don't know, changing a tire or something.
Yeah.
It's like, well, I mean, everybody should know how to change a tire just in case. I don't know.
No, I mean, I think I get what you're saying. The phone thing, conceptually, I like, but I think that it creates it kind of splinters this narrative because that's assuming more of a, and I'd written this down with some stuff, kind of like, the phone thing is more akin to me with Jane and Proctor, which is like, these are characters that are meant to indicate the collateral damage of progress, of people who, because of social strata or because of maybe some inability, they were unable to keep up with technology as it changed. And the phone thing, I think, then is applicable. Because the phone thing then, we're talking more about a generation who isn't comfortable with using that kind of technology, who's constantly complaining about how found often in the world is this kind of technology that they're unable to cope with. And this idea of, oh, no one wants to help me. Everyone's on their phones. No one wants to have a real conversation. Everyone's on their phones. Whereas, that makes perfect sense, but I see it in these characters. Whereas the overarching narrative, let me put it this way. There was a startup, and I think they're still going through with it. There was a startup that I read about not too long ago, where their whole product, they were creating this product and they were calling it Bodega, which for our listeners, a bodega is like a corner store in New York. That's what I don't know what it means, but that's just what they call them. I think everyone knows that. So this company was like, oh, we're going to make this product and call it Bodega. And the idea is it's a portable corner store. It's like a table size, like a 3x5 foot by like 2 or 3 foot box that offices would put in their break room or into their common space so the people don't have to leave the building. But big tech cities, you're looking at a New York, you're looking at San Francisco, Seattle, LA. You're looking at places where the corner store is an integral part of the community. And if you need something quickly, like that's what you want. Instead, you're replacing human interaction and a community mainstay with a piece of technology. You're eliminating human interaction. And there was a part of this that I think actually of the book that filters nicely into this idea, which was when he fucked Jane and he was talking about this idea of like neutral currency to with human interaction. And I had made a comment about a man enabled by luxury to be embittered by a past more favorable than he seems to imagine, and luxury's detriment and folly. So like you with the death of community and this box that's supposed to foster community within the office, you're not only separating groups of people with technology, you're creating a narrative where people aren't going to help each other. Like the American, like any of the people who saw him down in there who wouldn't help him. You're also creating a number of people who, like the Proctors and Janes, are left by the wayside as they can't keep up with this new form of technology, with something that's meant to, that is created to put them out of a job, put them out of business. And the users of this technology are then going to look at any other inconvenience in their life when partnered against this great convenience as something to fuel their embitterment or something to fuel their resentment with the way that they might be reacting to a changing time. I think that for the podcast, I guess just even in going on this diatribe and kind of what you were talking about with the phone and that idea of a parallel, contemporary parallel, I'm realizing now that this is a book for an essay, not a book for a 45-minute discussion. This is, because, you know, who are we to talk about the national or international ramifications or you know, generational ramifications of technology and how people interact with one another.
I mean, all the books so far have been books for essays, I think.
No, they definitely have. I don't know, maybe that's the... I don't know, it's just tough. It's tough because I'll feel like I'm really...
This was...
I don't know. No, sorry, this was what? What were we saying?
What?
So when we first started this podcast, there were, you know, with the third policeman and like Pedro Paramo, it was fun to read to just kind of think like, oh, wow, yeah, good book. Here's a couple scenes that I liked, good book, and then wrap up the pod. But after we read As I Lay Dying, I thought, you know, I want to start really trying to have a discussion on these books. I think it was around As I Lay Dying where I really picked out some phrases and started to like, because of the notes I'll take during the week, I'm just going chapter by chapter, but in going chapter by chapter, I'm still like, summarizing my thoughts. I'm laying the groundwork for an essay. So to read one of these books and have a lot of these thoughts, but then you find out amount of time and it becomes very difficult when you feel like there's something to be said that you're only scratching the surface on. You know, even with At the Mountains of Madness, I felt like we were going in the right direction, but just weren't allowed enough time.
Okay. I think I see what you're saying.
Yeah. What'd you think of it in all? You like it? You didn't like it? Give it a rating.
Yeah, good. I mean, it's definitely something where... Yeah, I'm not going to give it a rating. I mean, it gets...
Okay.
Give
me your favorite scene.
In terms of Jaguar parts, it gets most of the Jaguar parts in a car. You could almost assemble a full car out of it.
Okay.
That's what I'll say.
All right.
I mean, yeah, it's one of those where, I mean, I dare call it, or rather, I hesitate to call it like a dystopia.
Yeah.
It's, I think, better than a couple of the more stereotypical dystopias in terms of what it's actually trying to say, because it takes a little more of a introspective,
mm-hmm.
which I would prefer, certainly, to like, well, open your eyes. Open your eyes to the ways of society.
Right.
And it's like, look, let's not get into that. Whereas this one's very much a...
I mean, this is a reminder that we don't know how to interact with human beings, you know?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. A reminder is probably a good way to put it.
Yeah. Or it's like a cautionary tale. I mean, this was... Little, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, a little reminder to introspect. to think about this kind of thing. Yeah.
About class and entitlement and yeah.
Take a couple minutes, yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, I don't know. I think we're just about out of time for the week. Unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to talk about Infinite Jest. Hopefully next week we'll be able to touch base on that a little bit better and, you know, finally get into, after all these weeks, finally get into David Foster Wallace's seminal classic. Do you want to tell them what we're reading for next week, Steve?
Great. What did we decide on? Haji Murad by Leo Tolstoy.
There we go.
Is that the one?
Yeah.
That was the one.
Okay.
That's our tentative plan.
That's our tentative plan. And we're going to try and slate out a few weeks' worth of positive reading materials. I know we had got a PDF for, for Wild Boys by Burroughs. We're on Twitter at DFWADpod. Yeah. Shoot us an email at davidfosterwallaceandgromit@gmail.com. And be sure to subscribe on iTunes. We're going to be putting out a new episode next Sunday, get back in a normal schedule. And we'll see you then.
All right, Amazon, please sponsor us.